Men have the same genetics, lifestyle changes, and less than perfect diets as women do. But it is twice as likely for a midlife woman to have obesity compared to men. So what's the difference? The difference is men don't have hot flashes, men don't have insomnia, and men don't have a sudden drop in their hormones. I'm Dr. Lauren Streicher, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. You already know from episode 100 the details of why during perimenopause most women put on at least 5 to 7 pounds, and in many cases, that weight gain continues. And I go through lots and lots of strategies to help get to and maintain a healthy weight. But I am well aware that many women do everything right and still can't shake the extra pounds. Not to mention, many women weren't at a healthy weight before they had to deal with the challenges of perimenopause and menopause. It can be so frustrating, and I totally get why many women just say, you know what, forget it. It is what it is. Except being significantly overweight isn't just about vanity. Women with obesity are at a higher risk for diabetes, stroke, and heart disease, in addition to an increased risk for breast and other cancers. And that's when it's time to consider taking a drug to rein in your body's crazy metabolism and get to a healthy weight. So yes, I'm finally doing an episode on the GLP-1 drugs. I haven't been avoiding it on purpose, but since I never prescribe these drugs myself and don't consider myself an expert, I wanted to find the right person who not only understands how they work and what they do and don't do, but prescribes them routinely. And that person is Dr. Kathleen Jordan. Dr. Jordan is an internist and the chief medical officer at Midi Health, where she sets medical protocols and oversees a large staff of menopause experts to ensure that they are up to date on all new protocols and innovations on all things menopause. But a particular area of expertise for Dr. Jordan is in the use of the GLP-1 inhibitors to help women who are struggling with midlife obesity. This is not about celebrities who are desperate to get from a size 4 to a size 2. This is about women who need these drugs to be healthy. Welcome, Dr. Jordan.
Thank you. I love talking about the GLP-1s. It's been great to be part of bringing these to women and people.
Well, it's a hot topic. So before we get into the specifics, just like tell us, what is a GLP-1 drug? How does it work?
Most people know GLP-1s more by their brand names, right? So Wegovy, Ozempic, Mounjaro, Zepbound, right? Those are in the category of GLP-1s. GLP-1 just stands for glucagon-like peptide, which just tells us the classification of drugs it's in. So these drugs work on the receptor that's a GLP-1 receptor. It acts like our native glucagon and it blocks the receptor. So they work in three ways. So one, we have these receptors in our brain and it tells our brain that we are not hungry. In fact, it tells us it breeds satiety down.
Satiety meaning a feeling of fullness, right?
Yes, you like feel just, like
you're done, you're full, you've had it.
I always say it, you feel like you just finished Thanksgiving dinner, right? So you feel really full. So you remember when you feel that full, you don't feel like eating more. It tells our brain that we are full and it eliminates hunger. It also slows our gut down and that makes us digest food more slowly so we feel full longer. Also works on our pancreas. And then in our pancreas, it makes us secrete more insulin, which lowers our glucose, which is really why the drugs first came to market was really about the insulin properties and lowering blood glucose. So these drugs have been on the market a while for diabetes, but it turns out that managing our glucose and managing how we use energy also affects insulin sensitivity. So it affects how our cells use sugar and really affects our weight as well.
It's amazing how many drugs were developed for one purpose and then end up being very valuable for other purposes. And this certainly goes into that category. And as you said, they've been around a long time. I think people think that these are such new drugs when in fact, we know a lot about them because they have been around for a long time. As Chief Medical Officer of Midi Health, I'm guessing you're getting a lot of requests for these drugs. Are you seeing that?
Oh, we see it every day. So, I mean, statistically, we always talk about the basically 50% of US adults are struggling with obesity or being significantly overweight. But at MIDI, it's almost 90%. We actually ask our patients when they come in, 90% are having some kind of struggles with weight that they're looking for solutions for. And you've talked about before, right? In menopause, our metabolism changes, our insulin sensitivity changes. Midlife is when we weigh the most, actually. So later, we
Absolutely.
actually weigh less.
And let's face it, we know that women, that people often say, oh, this is lifestyle, it's lifestyle. Well, yeah, certainly white lifestyle is part of it, but we are also well aware that midlife women are twice as likely as midlife men to have obesity. And then, of course, there's all this stuff with, I talk so much about how you have to get adequate sleep in order to make sure that your hunger hormones are at the right level, so that we have to take care of the hot flashes and obstructive sleep apnea and all that stuff. So there's so many factors that go into it. But as you said, just because of the changes, because of that drop in estrogen and how we metabolize food and insulin resistance, it's like a quadruple whammy for midlife women. So no surprise that they are struggling. So when a woman comes to you and says, okay, Dr. Jordan, will you prescribe that drug for me? What's your approach? What do you kind of, what's the list of things you go through in terms of determining if she's a good candidate or not?
Well, first we make the conversation about health. This is not about aesthetics, right? We do want you to feel good about yourself and feel good about your weight and your body, but really we make it about your overall health and well-being, right? So as we gain weight, we bring what comes with it is a lot of risks, right? So our cholesterol goes up, our blood sugar goes up, our weight goes up, our blood pressure goes up. Right. So we're seeing a constellation of things happen that all make us at risk for heart attacks and strokes, which is the biggest killer of women. And we're midlife now, right? So these risks
Already at
become
risk
very
because of all
real.
the other things. Not to mention the
Age.
long-term issues. A lot of people forget that obesity is very much associated with many cancers. So this is about health.
It
So all
is
right.
about health.
Okay. So this woman comes to see you and she says, please, Dr. Jordan, prescribe this drug for me. So you go through her whole health history. So what things will make you say, yes, you are a good candidate. I'm going to prescribe this drug for you.
So certainly part of the conversation, and not the whole conversation, is about what is their weight and their BMI now, and what is their goal weight, right? When did they feel good? When did they have better numbers with cholesterol, glucose, and blood pressures, right? So let's talk about BMI. So BMI is not perfect, but for anyone who doesn't know their BMI, you can just Google it and there's a calculator. You just put in your height and weight. So it really is just a factor of your height and weight. BMIs that are associated with longevity, that our best longevity are generally around 20, so 18 to 22. And these drugs were studied mostly in people with significant obesity, right? So obesity is defined as BMI is 30 plus. And they were also studied in people with BMIs 27 to 30 that also had some other comorbidity, like a high glucose or hypertension or any other cardiovascular risk. So the studies were done on these drugs in these patients with BMIs above 27. That doesn't mean we restrict access to the drug for people with BMIs above 27, because there's other literature that says if you have a BMI 25 and above, you have increased risk for cardiovascular disease. So I want to protect my patients from cardiovascular disease because it leads to heart attack, stroke, debility, death, but also leads to dementia and, not feeling well, right? So hospitalizations. So for us, I think generally in categories where you're looking 25 plus, there's evidence that your weight is negatively impacting your health and you could benefit from a more aggressive weight management. The other thing is generally a lot, you're looking at a lot of weight loss. For persons with like BMIs of 22, 23 that want to lose 5 pounds, there's probably easier, more accessible, less invasive ways that we can help them get to weight loss. Like you mentioned, people are surprised, but like just helping them get a good night's sleep is associated with weight loss, right? Certainly exercise regimens help. Exercise actually helps prevent breast cancer as well, which surprises people. So there's other interventions with lifestyle, timed eating, also known as fasting diets can be
Intermittent
helpful
fasting
to
kind of
help.
stuff. Yeah.
Or just high fiber diets. Like, so there's adjustments you can do to achieve 5 or 10 pound weight loss without getting into this complex medical regimen, right?
Well, not to mention even the people that are good candidates, it's not like they're doing only that. You're going to advise them on other heart healthy and weight healthy approaches to lifestyle, to incorporate exercise, to make sure they get a good night's sleep, to make sure that even if they are eating less, that they're eating things that are good for them, that are healthy. You know, the processed foods, don't get me started on processed foods and the impact that that has had not only on weight, but just also on overall risks of serious medical conditions, you know, diabetes, heart disease, and all of that.
I want to double down on what you're saying, right? So I want to make sure listeners know that these drugs were studied in conjunction with lifestyle modifications. They're hugely supportive, right? So it's easier to eat less if you're not hungry and you feel full, right? So they're supportive of lifestyle changes. But you do have to be committed to the whole shebang. Exercise is hugely important because when you lose weight, a portion of your weight loss is muscle mass loss. And the faster you're losing weight, the more it is from muscle. So with these drugs, about 20% of the weight you're going to lose is going to be your muscle loss, which is not good. We're not trying to be frail, right? We need our bone health, we need muscle health.
Right. We don't want to
Generally,
be
people
skinny
want
and
to be
weak. We want to
toned.
be
Yeah. We
healthy.
want to be strong, feel good, healthy,
Yeah.
strong. So it's hugely important to incorporate a component of exercise to really combat and build up that muscle that you're losing with the weight loss. And then you're eating so much less, right? So what you eat really matters. You can't eat nothing all day and eat a bag of chips and expect to feel good, right? So our body needs nutrients, all sorts of nutrients. So you need the leafy greens, you need the colorful plate. Mediterranean diet is one we often talk about because it's the most associated with good outcomes for cardiovascular disease. But I really strongly encourage people to be ready to take on the program. So, your podcast talks a lot about hormone replacement therapy. So often women come to us with multiple needs. They want to lose weight. They're also having hot flashes, night sweats. Generally, sort of get them settled on the hormone replacement therapy if they're a candidate for it, or at least managing their symptoms, helping with sleep, doing other things, getting them going, getting them feeling strong, because you're about to engage in a whole lifestyle change and program. And to set you up for success, I want you feeling good, sleeping well, having the energy to exercise and participate.
And we know from very, very good data that women who have the most hot flashes are the women who gain the most weight, not just because of the impact on sleep, but also because of those surges of cortisol and all of the inflammatory outcomes that occur every time someone has a hot flash. So yeah, absolutely. It's not just here, do this and all will be well. It's really looking at the big picture. All right. So you've established who is a good candidate. And other than someone who just really only has a few pounds to lose, who would you say, no, you're not a good candidate. This drug is not appropriate for you.
Well, that's a great caveat. Obviously, someone who doesn't need to lose weight would not be a great candidate for the drug. But even that criteria is going away as we learn that it's helpful for other indications. We're using it for weight because that's where the most information is. But there is research going on because we've noticed that it's actually helpful with decrease in alcohol consumption. It may be helpful with smoking, other addictive behaviors, right? So
It's so
shoplifting,
interesting
gambling. We're
that
not prescribing it for those reasons, but we're definitely seeing a major reduction in alcohol
okay,
consumption.
so that's what I want to talk about for a minute, because that's honestly news to me, and that's huge, because when we look about midlife weight gain, a lot of it is due to excessive alcohol, because women are using alcohol not just because the kids are out of the house and they're going out to eat more and all of that, but because they're trying to get to sleep because of hot flashes and stress and all of that. And they're turning to alcohol, which we know puts them to sleep, but then they're going to be up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So I did not know that these drugs have been studied in terms of helping women
We're
cut
definitely
back.
seeing it. So what happened was these drugs came to market for diabetes. They noticed that people were losing huge amounts of weight and actually becoming healthier. Then they got approved for weight in 2021. So to your point earlier, these drugs have been around. The first drug came to market in 2004, liraglutide since 2010. We've been using it in humans since before 2000, right, in studies, right? But it wasn't approved for weight until 2021, which is where we've seen sort of the explosion of press mm-hmm. coverage and sort of the interest, right? So now we know the trials have been done. It helps with weight loss with huge efficacy. But we're also noticing that people are drinking a lot less alcohol. I have a patient that come in that says, I just don't have the taste for alcohol. I used to drink a glass of wine every day and now I don't. And she feels like it's great. It helps her sleep, which actually helps her feel really healthy. It's been sort of a very welcome side effect by many. So that's been noticed around the globe. So in Europe, they did a trial. They actually did a placebo controlled trial. It was a small, small trial. I think it was under 50 people, but it definitely showed a dramatic decrease in alcohol consumption in the people on GLP-1s. So now they're doing a much larger trial looking to see if it's an actual treatment for people that use alcohol use disorder.
It would be interesting to see if that would make insurance companies cover it for people who do not meet the usual requirements. So while we're on the topic of that, I mean, we certainly know that that celebrities are paying out of pocket, you know, but the people who are paying out of pocket and paying, they don't care what it costs. And we'll get to that. They don't care what it costs because they're celebrities. They have unlimited money and they need to lose 5 pounds. And we know that insurance is not going to cover that. So currently, and knowing that this changes and every insurance is different, but in general, currently, who will be covered to use these drugs by their insurance?
Whew, it's a whole topic.
And if you can't answer, if you just say no.
No, I can. We actually deal with insurance all the time. So we generally have to fill out prior auth requests for insurance companies to approve coverage. Generally, when the insurance companies are looking at approval, they stick to the original indication. So they will generally only approve for women who have a BMI 30 plus or a BMI 27 plus with the cardiovascular risk. And they don't go outside of it. That's it. That's their limit. That's the 50% of insurance plans that do cover it. About 50% of healthcare plans don't cover it at all. And as you mentioned, the costs are about $1,000 to $1,500 a month. But don't, you know, I want to give a big caveat there. So the FDA approved formulations from the pharma companies cost about $1,000 to $1,500 a month. What's happened is there's such huge demand that compounding pharmacies have begun to make them. And they make it, it's a generic version of it. It's of semaglutide, which is semaglutide is Ozempic and Wegovy, or tirzepatide, which is Zepbound or Mounjaro, right? So what a compounded pharmacy is it's a pharmacy, licensed pharmacist, that goes the extra step to get the certification to actually make drug on site. So generally, your local pharmacy is not making them. These are special pharmacies that are licensed for compounding. They have sterile rooms. They go through extra testing, extra licensing, and they'll make a certified sterile but home mix of the same ingredient, of the similar ingredients that are in Wegovy, Ozempic, or Mounjaro, Zepbound.
Okay.
And these are a lot more affordable. So this is really changing access. So these, when you order the compounded version of the drugs, these generally range from $200 to $350, depending on the dose and the drug and the pharmacy and the location. $200 to $350 a month, some as much as $500.
Okay. But Dr. Jordan, having said that, we know that there are compounding pharmacies and then there are compounding pharmacies. And certainly there have been a lot of reports in the news about people who are going to compounding pharmacies for these drugs and end up with drugs that are not of the same consistency, purity, that are not mixed up correctly, that are out and out counterfeit. So I think while it's legitimate to talk about compounding pharmacies, and both you and I rely on good compounding pharmacies for things that we cannot get commercially, there also needs to be a huge red flag for women who are looking for the cheapest option possible, that they may end up with a compounding pharmacy that really they're not going to get the quality they're not going to get the drug that they should get. And that's why it is so important to connect with a compounding pharmacy that you can rely on.
Oh, and with this drug in particular, people are going to Mexico, people are going to Canada, people are going to the back of hairdresser salons where they're mixing up these drugs and actually administering them. So, I'm sure we're going to get to talk about side effects later. I really don't want this happening for a variety of reasons. One, I want the drug to be pure, safe, and actually make sure you're getting what you're supposed to be getting.
Yeah.
So at MIDI, we vet the pharmacies. We make sure they're appropriately licensed and everything. We also do third-party testing where we make sure the drug is what it is supposed to be, right? So you want to go to a pharmacy that's been vetted and appropriately licensed. I do not want people getting it from the black market, but I think we have to listen to this. The reason people are doing this is because they're so desperate for these drugs. And we
not
need
only are
to
they desperate, but it's appropriate, it's beneficial. And we talk so often, you and I, about access, whether it's access to drugs, access to good medical care, access to experts. I mean, we have a lot of problems in the U.S. healthcare system, and we could go on and on about that, but this is certainly at the top of the list. But I want to circle back. So insurance coverage aside, who is medically, or is there anyone who is medically not a candidate for a GLP-1 drug beyond the person who simply just has only a few pounds to lose? I mean, is there anyone that you would say, boy, I think you would benefit, but because of fill in the blank, I don't think you're a good candidate.
Right. So there's a couple things on the drug label, right, that I want to address. I would say the one I sort of worry about the most is if you have pancreatitis or you've experienced pancreatitis on one of these drugs earlier. So we mentioned that GLP-1s act on the pancreas and the pancreas makes our insulin, but sometimes the drugs inflame this organ. And when this organ gets inflamed, it leaks and you can get abdominal fluid, you can get hospitalized. I mean, a severe pancreatitis can even lead to death, right? So it's not anything to muck around with. So people with a history of pancreatitis or have had pancreatitis when they started the drug before, we get off and we look at non-GLP-1 options to help them, right? I think that's sort of the most common one we worry about. There was an association with thyroid cancer in the animal model before these drugs came to market. So it is on the warning label. However, two caveats there. It was only medullary thyroid cancer, which is a more rare kind. So most thyroid cancers are papillary. So the label will say if you have a family history or personal history, but it's only of papillary. Subsequently to coming to market and seeing it being in mass use for persons with diabetes, we have data now that says it actually doesn't really cause this any problems with thyroid cancer in humans. So while it remains on the label, it's not really about most concern. And I think it would be a discussion about whether you would start on them.
I'm so glad you brought that up because people look at labels, of course, and the FDA labels are, quite frankly, sometimes misleading and don't change with the science. And the best example of that, of course, is you and I prescribe local vaginal estrogens that if you read the label, it tells you you're going to get a blood clot, dementia, and die of breast cancer. And you're like, okay, it's not worth it.
We laugh about that, yeah.
Well, no, we laugh about it. But the problem is that it causes people to avoid drugs, which would otherwise be beneficial. So I'm so glad you brought that up.
So there is one other thing on the label. It's about multiple endocrine neoplasia, which is a very rare tumor. If you have it, you're generally struggling with weight loss. You are definitely under the care of a specialist for endocrine tumors. They are not usually seeking weight loss, nor are they seeking these medications. So it really isn't really relevant to most of the population.
All right. So woman connects with you. She walks into your virtual office. You mutually decide that she is an excellent candidate and you prescribe this medication. What can she expect? How well do these drugs work?
Well, one of the reasons we're doing it at MIDI is that telehealth is such a great solution for giving these medications because you start the medications at a low dose and you titrate up as tolerated. Generally, about once a month, you bump up the dose. Some of the medications titrate a little bit differently, but by and large, you titrate up about once a month. You also have to manage the side effects. So if you can stay on these drugs, they're 97.7% effective. I mean, they work. About 15% of people, though, will drop off because side effects, right? But the side effects can be manageable. You should actually adjust your titration up based on the side effects. And then the side effects are generally like constipation, reflux, or heartburn, like things that there's both over-the-counter lifestyle, maybe some pharmaceutical things that can help with. The other thing is it causes nausea when you first take it, right? It's part of the satiety telling you that you're full. Right. But there, then you get used, your body gets used to it. So the second month you go up, usually the first week you take the medication, you feel some side effects, and then it's better by the third, fourth week. And then you get your next injection. Right. So your next bump up in dose. So you really have to go slowly up and ramp up. And that gives your best chance of success and your best chance of tolerating it and feeling well along the way. And a lot of times you don't actually start losing weight until you're into your second or third month. So this is not a quick fix bad diet. I need to lose 10 pounds by 4 weeks from now. This is a slow titration up. If you're going to start these, you're going to commit to be taking these for at least a year, maybe two, maybe in perpetuity, right? So you're going to slowly start. Once you start losing about 1 to 2 pounds a week, we stop titrating up. We just keep you at that dose and you stay on that dose until you start reaching your goal weight. Then we start titrating you down or spacing it out. The studies were done were in persons with diabetes. So these people stayed on the drugs. They needed it for glucose control. Those people have sustained weight loss. We have noticed when people come off the drug, many people gain back the weight. Not all people, and not even the people that gain weight don't necessarily gain all their weight back, but we are still learning on how to titrate people down or off. And that's sort of very individualized right now.
Well, let me ask you this, because that is one of the concerns, that you might lose the weight, get to a healthy weight, you go off the drug, and then you're going to boomerang right back. So what I'm hearing from you is that sometimes it's titrating down to a lower dose as a maintenance dose. You always talk about, you know, repair and maintenance, if you will. Mm-hmm. So you've got the maintenance dose. But in addition to titrating down the dose, you're also talking about spreading it out. So those are two different things. So has anyone kind of got to that magic secret sauce of what is the least amount that you can use or the least often that you can use it to maintain a current weight?
I think our recipe for the secret sauce is changing because there are new drugs coming to market. There's about, I think, 19 different GLP-1s coming to market in the next 2 years. A couple of the exciting ones are that they, A, some oral options that are not injectable, which eliminates that barrier. And the other ones are really long acting. So think about taking a drug and having it last a month. We're going to have new options on maintenance. Right now, it's individualized. We generally space it out. We go from every 7 days to every 10 days, also lower the dose, see what works for you. But I think our options will change. The NIH is also doing a trial on how to best support people coming off the meds and have it work.
Yeah.
I do want to emphasize, though, that about 25% of people come off the medication and have the weight loss sustained.
Over right? What period of time? Is there any data? Because there's a big difference between maintaining the weight for 6 months versus 6 years. So do we have that data yet, or it's too soon?
It is soon, because remember, it was only approved for weight loss in 2021. We did see people losing weight that had it for diabetes from 2015. So most of the data is looking at 1 to 2 years. So most of the data is 1 year off the med, how many people have sustained weight loss. Some do. I just want you to know some do, because as you're taking the medications, as people describe it, it sort of changes your patterns. It changes your relationship with food. Your whole day isn't surrounded by certain regimens of eating this and eating that.
You get used to eating less and eating and portion control.
Right. And even those that gain weight back in the studies, they're gaining about half their weight back.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to bring up the trial that came out in 2023 that showed in just 2 years, there was a 20% reduction in all-cause mortality, strokes, heart attacks, right? So huge impact in 2 years.
You know, it's one thing to say, great, now I can fit into my size 6 jeans, but it's another thing to say, oh my gosh, I have dramatically reduced my chance of dying. And we do have data which shows how people have reduced their risk of serious medical conditions. So can you address specifically what medical conditions are reduced and how much that impacts?
Oh, there's, well, we think about strokes and heart attacks and cardiovascular disease, but think about sleep apnea, right? Think about cancer, as you said. But I think what people don't realize is that obesity kills. If you have morbid obesity, which is a BMI above 40, your life expectancy is reduced by 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years. This is why I find it so distressing when they can't get the drug through health insurance. We're seeing women in their 50s, life expectancies to your 70s. So we're talking about expecting a mortality in 10 years. And I could, you know, if I could treat this, I can actually extend it to 20 years. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's really been amazing.
All right. So I have a question for you. I already asked you about the woman who comes to you and says, I would like this drug. What about the woman who you think would benefit, who's significantly overweight, you know, 80, 90, 100 pounds overweight, who says, I'm fine with my weight. I might be overweight. I might have a high BMI, but I'm healthy. What is your response to that?
I want them to be healthy. I'm going to support them in being healthy, right? So I think there is a lot of fatigue. I'll give you an example. I have a woman who has been battling weight and obesity, she describes, since she was been 10 years of age. She's exhausted by the conversation. She is exhausted with the efforts to actually address this. She said every minute of every day is about what she's eating, what she's not eating. It's become her identity. So generally we start talking about health, wellness, glucose, cholesterol, lipids. We talk about it as an option. We also set reasonable goals. I will say people don't necessarily want to be Twiggy. Yeah.
But what I'm getting at is we now have this culture that talks about being body positive, to accept your body no matter what the size. And on one hand, as you say, we're not looking for the world to be Twiggy, and we're old enough that we know who Twiggy is. And
I know most
people listening probably do, but for the younger people out there, Twiggy was a very popular model, what, in the 1980s, I think?
Before our era.
Yeah, I mean, and she was just ridiculously thin. It was just bad. And a lot of women modeled themselves after her, which was certainly not healthy. But we've kind of swung the other way. That this idea of, in the world of body positivity, that, you know, what do you mean I need to lose weight? I think I'm just fine. Everyone I know is my size. I'm happy being my size. My numbers look good. Do you approach that woman from the point of view of, okay, if you're happy with your weight, no issue here? Or do you, as an internist and a expert in this, do you come down and say, well, you might think that you're healthy, but in fact, you're still at risk for all of these issues down the road, including a shortened lifespan.
I do a few things. One is I ask patients what weight they feel healthiest and happiest at. And I let that's how we really get to a goal weight. It's not defined by me. BMI is an imperfect indicator.
Oh, we know that.
Yeah.
BMI is highly problematic. But I guess what I'm asking you, and it's not an easy question. It's a tough question.
It's a tough question in
because,
the visit.
It's really about kind of fixating on what is a healthy body and how do you define it? And I think you and I would both agree that BMI is certainly not perfect and that there are certain populations that BMI truly, truly is not an indication of health. But having said that, does a person exist who is 100 pounds over what we would consider to be a healthy weight, an ideal weight, who is nonetheless healthy? I mean, from my point of view, I kind of think, okay, you might think that you're at a healthy weight because your numbers are good and you feel good, but in truth, you are at increased risk for down the road cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and certain cancers. I don't know, am I coming down too hard on that?
No, I feel like my role in it is to inform the patient of options and tools to be healthy, right? So as BMI isn't perfect, sometimes actually getting a fat estimate. So there are studies you can do that look at percentage body fat. You can also look at waist to hip ratio. So if you're gaining your weight centrally and you have all your weight in the middle, that's actually a much poorer predictor of health than if you have your carry your weight sort of diffusely or as you did when you were younger, right? But so central weight gain is actually a poor predictor of health. Mm. So we talk about things like that. So if you are in a higher BMI You don't have central weight gain. Your glucose is fine. Your cholesterol is fine. We can get a calcium score, right, as a test of cardiovascular disease. So there's lots of information we can use. You generally are not going to find someone in a higher BMI that has a clean bill of health on these other things. So
If
there's
you look
generally,
enough, right, if you do the deeper dive.
Yeah. So you can do a deeper dive. There are some women that carry weight and can be healthy, body positive, and it's great. And again, we talked about it before, but to get into a weight management program that's going to work, you have to be all in, right?
Yeah.
This is a dedicated program. You're going to be taking medications. You're going to have to be dealing with insurance. I help you fill out the prior auth forms, but you're chasing down the pharmacy. The pharmacy's had supply issues. So just doing the medications is a dedication, but then the concomitant sort of changes in lifestyle and exercise are also part of it. And you do a monthly visit. Now, one of the reasons I love doing it at MIDI is if you go to a doctor's office, it takes on average about 3 hours. You got to drive there. You got to sit, wait. You got right?
So take time off work, all that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot.
The $48 Uber.
Yeah. But with MIDI, we make it easy. I have people do it from their car on their cell phone. They do it from their office. They do it on vacation.
And insurance covers these
states.
Visits. I think that's an important
And insurance covers the visits.
Yeah.
So we at least take away that barrier. The conversation we have with women is really about health. It's not judgmental. There is a lot of weight bias. There's a lot of accusation that you should be able to control yourself and that it's self-driven.
No, we know it's not, this notion that the reason you're overweight is because you're just not trying hard enough is insulting. It's insulting to women who have obesity because we know that metabolically and genetically, many, many people are at risk and struggle with this. And it's not because they don't know what to eat. It's not because they're not trying hard enough.
There are very organic differences. Yep.
Right.
Very organic differences that lead to obesity. It really is a disease.
To your point, when we talk about maintenance and weaning and all of that, if someone had diabetes and they were put on insulin, they generally are not told, and this is just going to be for a little while, you're going to go off. We get into this mindset of it's like taking an antibiotic. You have an infection, you take your antibiotic, and when you're done with the antibiotic, you're done. And that's very, very different than treating a lifelong chronic condition, such as having obesity. And I think you and I use the same language that we talk about having obesity because being obese implies that it's someone's fault, that they just had too many milkshakes, as opposed to having obesity, which is a medical condition like having hypertension or diabetes or anything else. So I want to talk about the differences between the specific drugs because we've got Wegovy and Ozempic and Mounjaro, and it's confusing. So can you just give an overview of what the differences are and what people should think about when, usually hopefully they're choosing it along with the professional, but what are these differences?
I mostly want to talk about semaglutides and tirzepatide because they're really the clinically relevant ones now. There was an earlier drug called liraglutide that was really the second to market, but really the first one mass used. Many people had it work and they still stay on it and it works and that's fine. But then there was a newer generation that came out really, and it was semaglutide, which is Wegovy, Ozempic, and then tirzepatide, which is Zepbound and Mounjaro, right? So these are really the options that we would turn to now. They have very similar efficacy rates, tirzepatide slightly higher, but we're talking about differences of losing 65 pounds versus 70. Like, they work.
Yeah.
We talked about the insurance barriers. Often insurance companies only cover one. So it's not that we often are choosing between them. We're usually looking at what the insurance covered option is and using it. And I am delighted to give you any of these options. All of these four work. Tirzepatide has a second mechanism of action. So they're all GLP-1s. There's a second mechanism called GIP that adds a little bit of extra oomph, I'll say, right? So it also gives you a little bit better glucose control and a just tad bit more weight loss. But we're talking about minor differences. Mm-hmm. So I want to give you one that you will have access to. Mm-hmm. We've had both insurance coverage issues and we've also had supply chain issues. I tend to choose the one where I think we're going to be able to stay on it because your insurance covers it and because there's not a supply issue.
Does the insurance ever cover the compounded options?
Unfortunately, they don't.
Unless someone's got one of those flexible spending accounts or something.
No. Yes, it is a prescription because we're prescribing.
Right, you're not selling drugs. You're writing prescriptions like any other healthcare professional.
So you can have an HSA. You can sort of apply it as a medical cost. It's not on formularies, so it would be subject to whatever those deductibles are.
What are the chances are that women are going to be able to go to their general healthcare clinician, whether it's an internist or a gynecologist or a family practice doctor, that doctor has the expertise and will be willing to prescribe these medications? Do you have any sense of that? Because we know you prescribe it, but a lot of people out there have a doctor. Chances are, is that doctor going to be willing to write a prescription?
So given the number of persons that could benefit from it across the U.S., our hope is that it really gets in the hands of most primary care clinicians. Because of all the barriers and the onerous prior auth forms and the supply shortages and the on-and-on paperwork that's thrown at us to access the drugs, some practices have not embraced it wholeheartedly and are waiting for it really just to be easier. Some say they're waiting for more data to come out, but I think a lot of it is around
it's just not comfortable with it.
It's not comfortable. It's also it's time consuming. We have, at Midi, we have a whole staff that fills out these prior auth forms and chases down getting them through insurance companies.
People forget that part.
You know,
I was in private practice
hard.
For so long. And one of our major expenses, and just in terms of keeping our office running, was we had one person who did nothing all day but prior authorization. It is ridiculous that this is such an obstacle to people getting medications that they need. And the expectation that the patient should do it for themselves is not right, but it's also not right that as physicians that we need to be responsible for that as well, that that's become our job. But that's the reality. So the last point I just want to make, because I know after listening to this, a lot of people are saying, okay, well, great. I'll just call up Dr. Jordan at Midi and she'll write a prescription. And I just want to be clear, it doesn't work that way because Midi is not an online pharmacy. Midi is healthcare like any other doctor. So if someone is interested,
we're a virtual doctor's office.
Right. So the point is, if somebody is interested in working with one of the Midi clinicians, you need to make an appointment just like you would for any other doctor or healthcare clinician who is going to take your whole health history and go through everything we've just talked about and decide if you're a good candidate and then write a prescription. So it's definitely an excellent option, but I just want to be clear. It's not as simple as saying, oh, I'll just contact Midi and tell them to write me a prescription. It doesn't work that way.
No. And actually I really want you to be under the care of a trained clinician because you do get little side effects that you need to sort of adjust the dose. You need to actually add. Maybe we'll stop titrating up. We'll give you a pause period until you get acclimated.
But you don't want to convince your regular doctor to write you a prescription, even if he or she has never done so, because it's nuanced. You need to be with someone who actually has experience in prescribing and managing the drug.
Right. And then when you get into sort of coming off the drug, right, you don't want to just stop cold turkey. You want to actually be with someone who's staying on top of the literature, understanding the options. Are we going to go to longer acting? Are we going to space it out? So we'll actually have an informed program. What's going to work best?
Yeah. All right. What didn't I ask you? I've learned so much and I'm so excited about actually the alcohol stuff. I think that's all new for me. But is there anything I haven't asked you about that you want to mention?
I just want people to know that we created Midi really as a way to eliminate access barriers. So we are in every corner of the US, all 50 states. You can sign on. We work hard to make availability within a couple weeks. And then the telehealth option is great because it does.
And covered by insurance. I think
that's covered by insurance.
Just like a brick and mortar doctor's office would be covered by insurance.
But we also don't control the supply shortages or the pharmacies, but we do vet them. And we use national mail order pharmacies that we have vetted and tested and send the drugs to if you're choosing the compounded route, and really have worked hard to get reasonable rates for the patients. So our commitment is actually to get women involved in their own health care and to feel good.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you. Thank you for spending this time. Thank you for explaining all of this so well. Now I feel like I really do understand this drug so much better. So I appreciate your time and I appreciate your expertise. And we'll have you back soon to talk about one of the many other topics that you have expertise in.
Yeah.
So thank you, Dr.
Thanks, Lauren, for getting the word out.
I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Inside Information books available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of.
Taking back your day.